We made this.
Hello everyone and welcome to the XCast special supplementary deep dive into the 66 Incident Part 2 Amor Fati. The truth is in here. This is going to be a really interesting one because it's got allusions to a film back in 1988 in the Last Temptation of Christ. I'm hoping that's the right year because I've completely tried to remember that off the top of my head. And we're going to be talking in depth about the episode and how it relates to that. But before we do that, there's a couple of things I need to go through. I need to introduce my guests, and I also need to just give this proviso that I have deliberately not listened to Carl and Tony's discussion on the main show about this episode. So I do apologise if we do go over some things that have already been covered in that recording, but I am told that they've spoken on that episode about us doing this. So we have two guests for this evening, and those guests are Marlene Stemmy and Darren Mooney. First up, Darren, it's been a while since we've spoken. You know, I think we've already recorded the Millennium episode, which is due to air soon. But the last time I spoke was probably back in the Time Is Now kind of era. So how are things going?
I love that much like Millennium itself, by this stage, the Time Is Now is almost completely forgotten. It's like, gee, I can't remember how long ago that was. It's like Chris Carter has had an additional show that was released and cancelled after only three episodes already. That's how long it feels like it's been. But no, it's good to talk. How are you?
I'm good. It's I've had my second job this week. So for COVID, as we're still in that kind of world at the moment, so I'll give it a couple of weeks and I shall be fully vaccinated and clear. And you know, I'm not going to go mental. I'm not going to go to the nightclubs in a few weeks' time or anything like that at all. But it does feel like you know, things are progressing now. You know, I've no longer got the grey hair, if we're going to use Frank Black illusions. but yeah, so I'm feeling good from that perspective. Work's been ridiculously busy. With a lot of things in COVID cases and isolations and all that kind of thing. So, you know, hopefully we're seeing, you know, the last kind of thing of, you know, of the real serious lockdown that we've had over the last 16 months, and we can start to see what the new world looks like. So, yeah, overall, I'm good.
You know, and you know, I'm really disappointed to hear you won't be out clubbing, because I was really looking forward to having you back on the scene.
Oh, no. Right, that is something I have missed. Dear.
Have you really?
Marlene, welcome. It's nice to see you. It's been a long time.
Yes, indeed it has. I'm excited to be here, but very tired, and you might say, having a far more mundane battle between the spirit and the flesh than either Mulder or Price is having in this discussion, and that my spirit is very willing to be here, but my flesh is ready to take a nap. So we'll see how this goes. I think it's going to be great.
So if we hear any of Darren or Kurt shouting, it's to wake Marlene up, in other words.
Or if I just start talking gibberish and you need to make a pun out of that, then by all means.
Ah, brilliant stuff. Okay. Well, seeing that we've got you awake right now, Marlene, I think it's, Darren spoke on Biogenesis last season. What do you make to these three episodes of season 6 and 7?
I've always liked them since they first aired. I've been a big fan. I think that they are artistically ambitious for the X-Files, just in general, and also for the X-Files. I think they kind of pulled some of the themes of the past and really brought the show in a new direction, really could have taken it in a new direction. I don't know that it was necessarily fulfilled as it was set up. But I like them kind of as their own trilogy. And I like that each, I don't know that this was the sort of the popular sentiment at the time, but I like that each episode in the trilogy is so narratively unique from the others. For me, that really works. On the kind of on the spiritual ambition part of it, I think they were going for something that was big. I think that there are parts of it that don't necessarily work out or pay off, but I like that they tried that, if that makes sense. I mean, I know that's a little bit vague, but we'll probably get into more of it. Yeah, I think it was a great direction for the show at that time and just enjoyable to watch. I tend to like those sorts of things, ask those sort of questions, kind of spiritual questions, but then also tie in the characters and the plot of the show. And then some of the, earlier on, more of the scientific focus, and then this one is almost entirely a psychological, spiritual focus. So I like that combination.
Darren, I'm just going to ask you a very brief question on just how we got here, really, because if you think about 2001 Son, the fact that you've got the Mulder, who's his most apathetic self we've ever seen, and you quickly flip this around to this episode, this Amalfati, where he is now going to be the savior of the universe. It's quite a swing, but it is an interesting swing because it's David Duchovny's choice to place himself in that position. Now, he himself has said in interviews that he was going for the everyman. But yeah. I always find it fascinating. Now, we'll get into this in more depth. I always find it fascinating. If you're going for the everyman, don't stick yourself on an operating table with a cross and a little metal plate around your head.
Thorns, yeah.
Yeah. Circle,
but I mean, the thing is, swinging for the fences, that you've gone from he's given up in 2001 Son to this being a brand new, in all case, but anyway, you know, it is a brand new mythology in a lot of ways. But it is an interesting swing that they've gone for.
Yeah, I mean, I am perhaps semi-controversial among X-Files fans in that I tend to think that there's an argument you can make that virtually every writer coming to the show writes their own little pocket version of the show. In that I think that, and they're all, they all stem off the main version. They are all Mulder and Scully in their own way. They're all different attributes of the same characters. But I think that if you look at, say, Vince Gilligan's work on the show, you get a steady body of work that speaks to Vince Gilligan's core themes and preoccupations, particularly little men who think that they're big. And you can position that in terms of things like, say, Breaking Bad, things like Better Call Saul. You look at things like, say, Glenn Morgan and Jim Wong's work on the show, and you can kind of position that, particularly, say, their fourth season work with the work that they did on Millennium in the fifth season, and it fits as a larger body of work. And I do think that, yeah, Duchovny's work on The X-Files, despite the fact that he's only credited on a handful of episodes, I would argue Duchovny is as much an author of The X-Files, or a particular strand of The X-Files, as any one of those writers I just mentioned, or Carter himself. I mean, and the thing about Duchovny, and it comes up absolutely every time we talk about him as an actor and as a writer, and I agree entirely with your, if you are positioning yourself as an everyman, and I think his argument is, the lamentation of Christ is about how we're all Christ, about how every single person on this planet has to make this heartbreaking choice between a life in the world and a life of the family. And it's like, yeah, but they also, not every person in this world thinks of themselves as Jesus Christ. I think there's a wonderful quote from Willem Dafoe in the movie that we're kind of comparing this to, The Last Temptation of Christ, where Dafoe said, years looking back, he was like, I still can't believe I had the arrogance to think I could play Jesus Christ. I think that with Duchovny has described his approach to writing as largely poetic. And that's most notable when we get to the episodes he wrote in the sixth season, The Unnatural, and the episode he wrote in the seventh season, Hollywood AD. And he talks about how he's a writer. He considers writing and directing to be poetry as much as any other art form. So it's a lot more abstract. It's a lot more vague. It's a lot less literally intentioned than he expects it to, many people kind of interpret it to be. And I think when you look at his work on The X-Files, arguably more than any other writer on the show or any other creative force in the show, it was Duchovny who pushed the show towards kind of archetypal Campbellian territory. In that it was, he got his first credit, I believe, on Colony, which is the episode that properly introduces the Bill Mulder as his father. And I know there you have this conversation the first season that sets up this idea of the strained father-son relationship, but it's really Colony where you start to see that. It's Anasazi at the end of that where you see that kind of reconciliation coming into effect. You see the death of the father then early on, you have that going on. And you have this idea of Duchovny steering Mulder's arc in particular towards this archetypal hero of a thousand faces kind of journey for the character. And kind of drawing in this idea of father and son. And then obviously Carter and Spotnitz build on it. And you have this whole back and forth thing that the show kind of pushes back and forth on. And you mentioned two fathers, one son, and you mentioned this. One of the bigger points of contention between these two episodes is one son ends with, the cigarette smoking man turning to Spender and saying, "Why couldn't you be a success? Bill Mulder's boy." as if to, like, finally close the book on the long dangling possibility that, you know, the cigarette smoking man was Mulder's biological father. It's like one son is like, no, no, that was Bill. He's Bill Mulder's boy. That the matter's closed. And then literally in the opening scenes of this episode, you have I am your father. It's like, okay, we are back on this again. And I find it interesting that, like, Duchovny is treating it as this grand mythic arc, because this is very much Mulder being presented with the opportunity to lay down his burdens, to turn his back on the heroic quest, to give up on what he's built his life around, and to accept retirement or mundaneity. Again, the last temptation of Christ, it's the moment, it's the last 40 minutes of that film where Christ is given the option to come down off the cross and to live a normal life with Mary Magdalene, to have a family, and to become fully human, and to give up his epic journey. So I think that's probably kind of how we get there, is that, like, Duchovny as a writer is very interested in these very big, very mythic, very archetypal journeys for the character that kind of push towards the father and son stuff, and then push towards, you know, the classic narrative stuff, and naturally the relationship between Jesus Christ and God, and the Gospels are arguably one of the core foundational texts. So I see where we end up with kind of what we have here and this interpretation of Mulder. I would say that would be my kind of broad strokes take on it, I think.
Oh no, I was going to say, like, I think that Colony was his first, if I'm not mistaken, his first, David Duchovny's first story credit, and then this was his first actual written by credit. And I think that there's a difference there, because I think a lot of the content that we'll discuss, both from the book and the movie, The Last Temptation of Christ, is very overt in this, whereas I think that story, like Darren was talking about, and some of those archetypes are more, I mean, they're more the X-Files mythology, yeah, with layers of that, whereas I think that this is such a direct, I mean, yeah, directly lifted both from the book and the movie. I mean, there are parts of it that are just, you know, I mean, I think it's an homage, and rather than, you know, plagiarism. Yeah, no, I mean, it's intended very, yeah, specifically to mirror that content. And I think that that's a very kind of an interesting evolution, seeing David Duchovny contribute to stories, and then, as you were saying, the development of how he is perceiving those relationships archetypally, but then going into his first writing credit, where it's just such a direct thing, and then brings in so much more of the, like, whatever the, you know, the original content. And I think it's just, as a little side note, I think it's interesting too, as, like, a lot of the X-Files has to do with dual nature, like the person's dual nature or a being's dual nature. And that's, I think, a big part of, well, of, you know, like, the biblical story of Christ, and then also of The Last Temptation of Christ, the way that Kazantzakis wrote it and the way that Scorsese directed it really pulls out that sort of struggle. And I think both Colony and, you know, The Last Temptation and The Sixth Extinction, Amor Fati, really focus on that as well. And so I kind of like that theme that goes through there. And I think the overtness of the content makes you better able to kind of see all those parallels going along too.
Yeah, I mean, was The Unnatural not a written by just him though, as well? That was season 6, wasn't it?
Yes.
So that was the season before this.
That's true. That's a good point. I guess it's his first, like, mythology written by credit.
Yeah, and Bounty Hunter as well, which is his character probably. But no, the reason why I mentioned The Unnatural for is just for you, Marlene, just for yourself, really, is. As Darren alluded to, and as you've spoken about there, it's interesting how, like, sort of it permeates through, like, sort of the Campbellian story that obviously David Duchovny is really interested in, mm-hmm, but also the, you know, the way that things have developed, that he's been let loose on, say, The Unnatural, for example, and the abstract nature of that episode, and then to come from that to this, mm-hmm, which is like, it does feel there's a progression there, and then obviously we're going to see Hollywood AD, yeah, later on in the series as well.
And that's interesting too, because there's that emphasis on transformation and the unnatural that comes into Amor Fati, and then also I think goes into Hollywood AD quite strongly.
And we should note, by the way, actually, just to get this out there, because, like, Duchovny is a very intellectual writer in terms of, like, you know, I mean, there's a Cosmopolitan interview, I think, from, like, 96, 97, where they talk about him keeping a copy of Campbell's Heroes with a Thousand Faces kind of in his trailer. There's an interview he did with Playboy where he talks about, like, how, as an actor, he wants to give Mulder a Joseph Campbell journey. I think we talked on, like, The Time Is Now, Kurt and I, about how when Glenn Morgan and James Wong took over running the the second season of Millennium, one of the challenges that they faced as writers was that Lance Henriksen was a more intellectual rather than an emotion, sorry, a more emotional rather than intellectual actor. So they found that like they could talk to Duchovny and they could explain the character's arc in mythic terms. But with Henriksen, he needed a more emotional hook to go into. He didn't have that kind of appreciation for the Campbellian monomyth. And I think it is like, particularly in terms of Duchovny, it's worth noting, famously, he was, I think, one paper away from completing his PhD in English, if I'm not mistaken.
He was all but dissertation.
Which is, and again, that's kind of like, I think that's where you see him coming from, because his work is very, very postmodern, very self-aware, mm-hmm. very understanding of how myths work or how stories work.
I mean, one of you might be able to answer this because I haven't looked into this too much, but because as you mentioned, it's more of an homage than a strict plagiarism of the thing. It's almost like a love letter to it. Do you remember much in the press around this time or what was happening around this time regarding the fact that, you know, it was obviously such an homage to it?
You mean the press around the X-Files doing?
Yeah, but around the X-Files doing, yeah, the Last Temptation of Christ kind of thing when it mm-hmm. originally aired.
I remember knowing that that was what that was going to be, and I was familiar with the Last Temptation of Christ, but because I remember I was very young, but I remember when the movie came out and some of the press around that and the controversy about that and so forth. So I was interested in it. I hadn't watched it and I hadn't read the book, but I did both kind of in preparation for the X-Files episode, knowing that it was going to have that content in it. So I remember that being, you know, among those people that would follow and read about the X-Files. I think it was, you know, they were aware of that. I don't know just generally that anyone else or the casual viewer at that time would have put that together.
Yeah, there were, like, Duchovny, to his credit, was like fairly open when talking like to Cinefantastique, for example. There's a couple of tweets. Eat the Corn is very worth seeking out. And like a lot of the commentary that I could find from Cinefantastique, including people like Paula Vitaris and Dan Pearson's. I love Dan Pearson's like take on Amor Fati, where he asks, daring dramatic experiment? Or Duchovny's calculated over-dramatized retort to his tormentors in trying to figure out, like, where exactly Amor Fati lies in, like, David Duchovny's, like, artistic statement of where he is right now. But I do think there was an awareness of it. I think, like, that metatextual aspect is certainly not new. It was there on broadcast, mm-hmm. and it was certainly they were talking about it as well, I think.
Well, let's, before we start talking about in depth about it then, let's briefly discuss The Last Temptation of Christ. So, Darren, you've just done a summer of Scorsese last summer. I don't think you touched upon Last Temptation, did you? I think it was one of the films that you didn't cover. But at the time of Aaron, Marley mentioned the controversies. I mean, can you give us a brief insight into kind of what the controversies were there and kind of the reaction to it after it was released as well?
So as you alluded to last year on the podcast that I co-host 250, we did a summer of Scorsese, looking at Scorsese's movies on the IMDb 250, and occasionally sprinkling in bonus episodes along that. We didn't get to cover Last Temptation because, like, there are I think 40 Scorsese movies,
yeah,
and that would be a year of Scorsese, and we weren't quite ready to commit to that. So that was unfortunately one of the ones we skipped. But I did watch along as I went. I tried to keep up and to follow his career as it goes, and Scorsese's career in the 80s is fascinating. But long story short, in terms of Last Temptation of Christ, Scorsese is, I would argue, one of the great Catholic American filmmakers, in that his Catholicism is essential to his filmmaking, and not just like The Last Temptation of Christ. I mean, the cliche of Scorsese as a mob movie director, all of his mob movies, I would argue, have a very Christian theology. I think like Casino in particular is a movie about what happens when men think God isn't watching. But even things like Silence, things like Mean Streets, all like throughout Scorsese's filmography, there's a very Christian, very Catholic worldview. And famously, when he was shooting Boxcar Bertha, X-Files, future X-Files guest star, who Marlene pointed out we will have to reference later on as well, Barbara Hershey, was filming Boxcar Bertha with him. And she brought the book to Scorsese. Scorsese read it. He was immediately taken with it. He had, at that stage of his career, already decided that he wanted to, at some stage, do a biblical movie, because he was, again, like many of the you know, the Hollywood brats, the movie brats, he'd come up like of a generation with the movies of the kind of 50s or whatever, and he wanted to make his own biblical epic. It took him, you know, nearly 20 years to work up the credibility and the kind of like support to be able to do it, to get away with making it, in large part because the collapse of the New Hollywood movement at the end of the 70s, his own failure at New York, and then slowly building credibility by making bankable movies, like, for example, The Color of Money with Tom Cruise, that sort of stuff. Eventually convinced, and I believe it was Paramount originally agreed to give him $14 million to make the movie, which was a tiny budget at the time for what was essentially a biblical epic. The book that he was adapting was usually controversial. When it was announced that Paramount, Gulf and Western, the company that owned Paramount, would be financing this picture, there was public outrage. There were organized boycotts, very similar to the kind of stuff that you arguably see today in certain cultural spheres when projects are announced and people get very upset about them online. And there are kind of like targeted campaigns. Gulf and Western pulled out, and Scorsese had to try and figure out a way to get the movie made. And again, that controversy within Hollywood is notable because you had a number of people at like Paramount, like Jeffrey Katzenberger, leave as a result of it and head over to Disney. And that then ripples through and creates its own future of Hollywood mythology. But Scorsese manages to scrape the money together, manages to make the movie. It is released in cinemas. There are protests over it because it's seen as being blasphemous. And the reason that it's seen as being blasphemous is that it presents a very human take on Christ, in particular his relationship with Mary Magdalene, played by Barbara Hershey, who argues that like Scorsese had to cast her because she originally gave him the book. But you have this idea of it promoting a blasphemous view of Christ, and it's protested and it is banned in several countries. I believe it was banned in certain countries up until 10-15 years ago. And yeah, that is it basically. It was, I don't know if it was ever actually screened in Ireland where I lived, when it was released, because it was seen as being an anti-Catholic text, which is ironic given Scorsese would consider himself to be, and I would consider him to be, one of the great Catholic filmmakers. And I think there is a school of Catholic criticism that argues that both the film and the book are quintessentially Catholic texts, because they grapple theoretically with the idea of what it means for Christ to be both human and divine simultaneously, and trying to reconcile those two in ways that the canonical gospels don't necessarily entirely square. But again, that's a very rough overview of the kind of like the controversy around it.
Yeah, I remember, like I said, I remember like vaguely at that time, the controversy. I mean, I think, you know, I think you're correct about the protest was about, you know, at the time was the sort of seemingly earthly nature as presented of Christ and his relationship with Mary Magdalene. I mean, I think the theological sticky wicket is this idea that Christ could be tempted either psychologically or physically into abandoning his mission, that he wasn't, you know, saw himself as not being the Messiah or what have you. And then from that, you have some of the like the sexuality and things of that sort. I don't think that that itself, in my mind, isn't the part that is heretical. And I would say, I mean, I don't think there's a way of getting around it being heretical. In my opinion, it would be heretical, not blasphemous. But the heretical part is kind of interesting because then it's you know, it's like you said, it's a different take on the Gospels. And I think that that's what, like when Nikos Kazantzakis wrote it, I think that's what he had in mind, was this different approach, not necessarily a vertical approach to like to the Gospels and to the presentation of Jesus, but then showing the struggle, you know, like we've talked about a little bit. So yeah, I think the controversy around it probably, you know, like sort of fueled the imagination a bit. But I don't think that it was intended to be controversial or to be completely irreverent. And I think even in watching the movie and reading the book, there's a lot of reverence. And I think that Kazantzakis had a lot of reverence for Christ and for just his own very interesting journey through many, you know, schools of thought in his life and coming back to Christianity.
Just in terms of reverence as well, like one of my favorite little details about like The Last Temptation of Christ is Scorsese banning cigarettes from the set because he was worried about photos of Willem Dafoe as Jesus Christ being seen smoking.
That's funny.
Like that, which I kind of, it's a very Scorsese anecdote.
Yeah. With his Catholicism then, the fact that, where would you place it in Scorsese's body of work, Darren, in the way that Scorsese's viewed?
I mean, I think that the thing is, like, Scorsese's 80s work in general has arguably undergone something like of a kind of like a reassessment. One of the interesting things about Scorsese's career, which I find completely insane, like completely insane and like something I cannot account for and I kind of love about it, is that like Scorsese spends the bulk of the 70s kind of like trying to chase like the new Hollywood movement. He's part of it, but he's trying to chase Spielberg and Lucas, who are like the guys who invent the blockbuster. They become like breakout hits, and they're the two guys who arguably survive the collapse of the new Hollywood movement when United Artists collapses after the release of Heaven's Gate. Spielberg, by, you know, making like Raiders of the Lost Ark and proving he can make cheap, effective blockbusters that are crowd pleasers and artistically well constructed, and Lucas by like having invented Star Wars and having all of the money in the world. And like Scorsese, you read interviews with Scorsese and they're stunning, because Scorsese makes these movies in the 70s and into the 80s that are abrasive, confrontational, and deeply unpleasant. Movies like, say, New York, New York, which is an MGM musical about a deeply abusive and dysfunctional relationship with Liza Minnelli and Robert De Niro, which is really well made, but one of the most unpleasant movies I have ever watched by virtue of spending time with these characters. And you read interviews with Scorsese and he doesn't understand why that doesn't connect with audiences. He's like, I thought it would be a huge hit. I thought it would be a blockbuster. I thought people would be queuing up in the streets to see it. And like, he spends his entire career chasing this stuff and chasing the Oscar. There's the great story about, is it Ileana Douglas tells, about how when he was nominated for Best Director for Goodfellas, in 1991-92, right, he was like at the awards, Goodfellas, everyone's like, Goodfellas, possibility of winning one of the most influential American films like of the decade, masterpiece. And instead they give Best Picture and they give Best Director to Kevin Costner for Dances with Wolves. And according to Ileana Douglas, and I love this, Scorsese apparently complained on the ride home that they put me in the front seat with my mother. They had my mother there and they didn't even give it to me, which I kind of love in terms of like understanding Scorsese's fixation with this. And he manages to, but like throughout the 2000s, so into the 90s and into the 2000s, there's this thing where he's like, okay, he keeps making movies and he gets to make his passion project, Gangs of New York. And he's like, yep, this is my blockbuster. I want to make this since the 70s. And it releases, it makes a reasonable amount of money and everybody just kind of shrugs. And he ends up doing, is it like The Aviator? And he's like, The Aviator might be the last movie that I make. And he only makes The Aviator because DiCaprio calls him up and says, hey, Michael Mann dropped out. We worked together on Gangs in New York. How should you like to make a $100 million movie? And Scorsese's like, sure, I'm not doing anything. And he's like, okay, this is grueling. And he gives all this press about how it might be the last movie he makes. Gets released, makes a shed load of money. And then he's like, okay, fine. And he goes and he does The Departed. Apparently he has like one of the worst experiences of his life making The Departed. He hasn't been exactly clear on why it is. You get a sense from the press that it might be either working with Nicholson or working with Warner Brothers. One of those two experiences. Scorsese hasn't been clear on which, but he's like, I don't think I'm making movies after this. And then The Departed becomes a massive box office success. It ends up like winning Best Picture. It finally gets Scorsese his Best Director Oscar, which is presented to him by like Spielberg, Lucas, and Coppola, which is very much the welcome to the club kind of thing. And then you have this weird situation where, regardless of what you think of Scorsese's recent output in terms of quality, regardless of how you place it in the Scorsese canon compared to his classics in the 70s or the 90s, this is his most critically and commercially successful decade. He has, like, the release of, The Departed and Shutter Island are both, like, box office smashes. Like, huge critical hits, huge commercial hits, very popular. And so it's really weird because it feels like Scorsese was this weird art house director who made oddities that, you know, nobody but film critics seemed to love for most of his career. And then when he finally threw up his hands and said, look, I can't do this anymore. I'm done. I'm out. All of a sudden, he turns into like the hottest like movie director working. Was it like Wolf of Wall Street, I think, was for a short while one of the highest grossing or rated movies ever made. And it was a Christmas box office smash, a 3-hour movie about opulence and corruption on Wall Street. So I find, like, in terms of positioning, like, The Last Temptation of Christ in terms of Scorsese's filmography, I think when it was released, there was a bit of a kind of a shrug around it. Like, critics liked it, but it wasn't regarded as a classic. It wasn't regarded as a career resurrection from a director who needed it. It was seen as being part of, like, his work of the era alongside, say, After Hours, as we mentioned, The Color of Money. Just a movie that he made. And then over time, its reputation has grown, I think, where people are going, hey, this is actually a masterpiece from a director.
Wasn't he nominated for an Academy Award for it?
Let me just check that to be sure.
Wrong, but I want to say I read that.
So just checking his awards here. So in terms of Academy Awards, he was nominated for Best Director for it. It was his second nomination behind Raging Bull. Now, to be fair, he was also nominated for Goodfellas, Age of Innocence for writing, director for Gangs of New York, and directing for Aviator. But he only won with The Departed back in 2007.
This is going to pull us more into the X-Files realms. I don't know if we're finished with Martin Scorsese, but I was wondering if you think, and I'll tell you why first before you answer, if you think of Chris Carter as being somewhat of a Catholic writer. Now, I know that he's not a Catholic. He wasn't raised Catholic. But I was thinking about his collaboration, you know, in this, in Amor Fati with David Duchovny, and then also in I Want to Believe with Frank Spotnitz, both of whom have a far more humanistic, I think, take on the world and on people than Chris Carter does. And obviously some of the Catholicism that we see is like through Scully. But I also think that there's something to the nature of both of those that is inherently Catholic. Now, I'm not Catholic, so I probably shouldn't be talking like this, but that's something that I kind of wonder, I think he's bringing to that, and I wonder how you see that in him as a writer. And also like the things that you've talked about and that we've all talked about on the podcast about like the nature of good and evil and how like his presentation of that differs in some of the other writers also makes me think that he has kind of that, a hint of Catholicism in him as a writer.
Yeah, I mean, actually, like I think, and I'm kind of rushing to kind of like bring up the information notes that I have here, but I do think I remember Carter saying that like one of the interesting things about it is that he became increasingly open to the idea of faith over the longer the show ran, and particularly like in the work that he did in I Want to Believe as well. And it's kind of funny because we've talked about it on Millennium on like the Time Is Now podcast as well, where you have like a recurring theme there is the idea of, well, as you mentioned, good and evil, and the idea of Carter as somebody who believes, you know, and again, it might be overly simplistic for me to frame it like this, but Carter believing that evil is something that exists outside of us and gets into us and changes us and corrupts us, as opposed to, say, something that begins inside of us and manifests out through us. But I do think that there is an argument for him as, I suppose Catholic is probably a good way to put it. It would be a theology or moral worldview that I would recognize through my own upbringing. I should say I am a lapsed Catholic. I am kind of agnostic now, but I did grow up in the Catholic Church, and I did do Sunday school and all that sort of stuff. And the way in which there's a lot of the morality of the X-Files and the morality of Carter in general that I do kind of resonates with me on a kind of a primal level, which is this idea of we are flawed creatures trying to understand the world, trying to gaze upon and make sense of a world that is governed by forces that are larger than us and perhaps beyond our comprehension, and all we really have to go on is fate. And in particular, and again, this is something I think I talked about with Kurt on The Time Is Now, one of the interesting things about Carter's work as a writer and director, and again, this is something that I consider personally, I'm not speaking as anybody with any theological expertise, to be clear, but it's just something that when I see it in his work, I think this is something I associate with Catholicism and my religious faith, or the religious faith I used to have and kind of still never really kind of let go of, is Carter's preoccupation with the idea of sin, redemption, and in particular, forgiveness. And I think like if you look at something like, and again, I don't think we're going to delve into these stories in much depth, but things like, say, I Want to Believe, where you have Father Joe, the character played by Billy Connolly, who is a sex abuser, but like he was a child sex abuser. But you have this idea, this question that runs through the movie of, can he be redeemed? Mm-hmm. Can he do something good despite having done something terrible? And you see it again in the revival in Babylon, which again is another kind of messy, complicated story. But it's a story about a boy who tried to kill a bunch of people in a terrorist attack. And you know, this idea of kind of like, is he redeemable? Can we feel empathy or compassion? Can we forgive him for doing this terrible thing? And that is something that I do see a lot in Carter's later work. And I think that's kind of when I think of, you know, when you ask, is Carter a kind of a Catholic storyteller? That's kind of, those are the places where my mind goes. I don't know if that's a fair answer or a correct answer, but that's kind of just where my head goes on those themes.
Yeah, I think that's really interesting. The Father Joe part makes me, and I'm, you know, I could go on about I Want to Believe forever, but I'll make this somewhat brief for now. I think that there's the...
Wait to the I Want to Believe minute, Marnie.
right. every minute, every minute, just hours on every minute of it. But I think that there's the idea in that movie, there's between this worldly recognition of redemption and then what Scully realizes that Father Joe perhaps is going for in the end, some sort of like spiritual redemption, or not necessarily a recognition by the world. That wasn't what was important. But I think that that kind of ties back through through Amor Fati and through The Last Temptation of Christ and this argument that Judas and Jesus have at some point earlier on about the like physical rebellion. Like, is it the body that needs to be freed first, or is it the soul and what's primary and so forth? And to make this like a really broad association, it kind of makes me think about what we were talking about when we first began the discussion, talking about like some of the things with two fathers and one son. I just associate season six with very, as real world as the X-Files can get, like those kind of answers, like here is what happened narratively. Whereas season seven, to me, some of the mythology in that is more, I don't want to say like just the spiritual realm, but it's kind of like, how is this experience conveyed? And what is this, like the meaning of this for people? And like, what really is freedom? Is it actually having this answer? Like, here is what veridically happened? Or is it, you know, how are you accepting this? So there's that aspect of it. And then I think too, season six has all of these questions about what is the normal life, and showing a lot of like undercurrents that the normal life, you know, so-called, is not everything it's cracked up to be. So that was another reason why I like really like season seven, why I, to go further into it, I've always deplored existence. I think that that was kind of a violation of everything that came up in Amor Fati. And then why I really like I Want to Believe again so much, kind of redeemed what I saw as the problems from the end of the, you know, Mulder and Scully story in existence. So all of that to say, I feel like there are these kind of like two worlds again wrestling together, and that's, you know, that's sort of the show's way of dealing with that.
Well, you couldn't have led me in any better than that, Marlene, because right. one of the first scenes that we need to talk about in the X-Files episode, Amor Fati, is Cigarette Smoking Man's journey in the car with Mulder. And in any previous seasons, you would never have heard Cigarette Smoking Man say, "You've been asleep a while, I expect it will be sometime before our sleep patterns return to normal. Would you like an explanation?" That's like completely like different to every single conversation that we've had with Cigarette Smoking Man with Mulder before.
Well, that's a temptation too, and isn't it?
Exactly, exactly. So yeah, so I think the obvious start would be to let's discuss some of the you know that we're going to be discussing both the film and obviously the episode. But Cigarette Smoking Man's a good place to start, being that, you know, he's very thematic, the bad guy, as we move into later seasons especially, and he becomes a bit more comic booky. But Cigarette Smoking Man in this temptation, Marlene, what are your thoughts on him?
I think the direct mirror is, so for those that have not seen or read The Last Temptation of Christ, there appears in the crucifixion scene this young blonde girl at the cross that tells Jesus that he's done enough and that he's basically deserves to lead a like pleasant, happy life, essentially, and that he's pleased God and that's all he needs to do. And it turns out in the end, like he sort of, you know, takes Jesus away. It's, follows him throughout the rest of his life as Jesus lives out his life and becomes an older man and so forth, and kind of abandons this mission that he had or that he thought he had. And then in the end, I believe Judas reveals. So Judas's role is different too, just for those who are not familiar with the story. This is the other part that's kind of a big twist on the biblical story, where Judas is like truly the betrayer of Christ. In The Last Temptation of Christ, Christ asks Judas to betray him and says that he has the harder job because he has to betray his friend, essentially. And so that was his part of this divine plan, was to betray Jesus so that the crucifixion could take place and the resurrection and so forth. So at any rate, when in the story, Christ is an old man and the disciples come to him, Judas, I believe it is, reveals that the little girl is the devil. She's indeed not a guardian angel, but has lulled him into this like false life. And so in the Last Temptation of Mulder, in Amor Fati, we have Scully coming in and really reciting those lines that, not to get too far ahead, but they're like directly, this is the, you know, the part that I said was like just directly lifted from the book in the movie. that he's, that Mulder is, you know, when he's talking about him being a traitor and a coward and a deserter and so forth, that she says that the cigarettes man, his smoking man, has lulled him to sleep, that his place isn't to be lying as an old man, you know, dying in this bed, and that he's on a mission, but cigarette smoking man has kind of taken him away from all of that. So I think that, you know, later on, like you mentioned, he's kind of this devil figure in a kind of cartoony, a little bit trite way sometimes. But I think in this, and we've seen echoes of it before, I think, in Talitha Kumi, of him like sort of as this devil figure. But I think in this, he's portrayed very interestingly in that same light as the sort of little girl in the movie that is the great tempter. But it's, you know, you think of him as having, like he's a nice man in this for the most part. And he takes Mulder away from this pain of his life. And he, you know, is paying for a family and he's feeding this family and he has this big house because he's a family man. And so you want to associate good things with him, just like you would in The Last Temptation of Christ with this little girl that is supposedly healing Christ on the cross and so forth. So I like that take of him as the devil in this. I think that it has a lot more nuance and resonance than just kind of this creepy old guy that he became.
Compared to the film, you see the guardian angel arrive at the crucifixion and she talks through stuff mm-hmm. with him, and basically we get the exposition for what we need to see moving forward. And we don't know, we just, if you look at it from a perspective, I know we had the scene earlier in with the circle stones and the apple tree and, you know, the flaming mm-hmm. fire in the film. But if you take it at face value, you can take it at face value. But with the cigarette smoking man, we've got so much weight behind who he is. And it's really interesting that, you know, as I say, rather than it being like a direct lift, it can't be, because it has to be, you have to have the weight of what cigarette smoking man has before that.
Yeah.
And I find it really, really interesting that that cigarette smoking man, and if you go back to like, say, things like the Redux trilogy where his sister's shown, and all of that comes back when you go through and you see that she's living across the street and things like that, which is all, I would say, playing in his mind, which is another thing as well, which it seems like this is coming from within Mulder's mind compared to what The Last Temptation of Christ is more what's being given to him. So I find that just really interesting that Cigarette Smoker Man takes place in that, and that he is effectively that guardian angel. I mean, what's your take on it, Darren?
I mean, as Marlene pointed out, like, the show has been fairly explicit that he is Lucifer or Satan to this point. I think it's a memento mori where, like, is it Skinner asks, did you take the elevator up to work today? Or I thought I smelled sulfur or something like that at one point, another character remarks. Here you have, even like he's introduced, where Mulder says, you know, I can hear you like a snake hissing underneath. Yeah, which is an image taken directly. Yeah. And, you know, the cigarette smoking man, to be fair, responding with a little bit of self-awareness and asking, do you expect me to sprout vampire fangs? And I do think that it is kind of an escape. But again, the thing with this is that, like, you know the outcome of this. This is not this is not a season finale. This is the second episode of the seventh season. You know that, like, it's not going to end with Mulder going off with the cigarette smoking man, accepting that he's not such a bad guy after all. And maybe we should spend the next, 18 to 20 episodes of the season with Mulder just, like, taking part in the local book group. I think you know, by virtue of this being the second episode of the seventh season, that, like, Mulder is always going to reject it. And I think that, so the weight of the cigarette smoking man being the person making the offer doesn't really matter as much as the little blonde girl who, you know, does present herself as an agent. She presents herself as an angel. She says that she's Jesus's guardian angel and then turns out to be Lucifer. Whereas I think that, you know, here, the fact that, you know, the smell of sulfur and nicotine are in the air. Mm-hmm. That it's like, yeah, no, this is Mulder is always going to reject this. And we'll probably come back to the Judas stuff, because I think the Judas and Scully stuff is interesting, even outside of the fact that Harvey Keitel has, like, striking red hair in The Last Temptation.
Oh, yes.
Yeah.
I mean, I definitely think
I didn't factor that.
Yeah. The redhead. Judas.
Yeah.
I think this cigarette smoking man, it's a reflection of the guardian angel character, because it's obvious that not only because it's the second episode, but because of, like, what Kurt was talking about in the background, we know this character, Mulder, is not going to end up with him permanently just because of the nature of the show. But I do think that it opens up, like, a deeper look at the story, given that he's put in that parallel position.
Yeah. And I mean, like, he does make the point, like, when he's talking with the surgeon played by, I think it's Brian George, like, I kept him alive all these years. So, like, in a certain weird and twisted way, the cigarette-smoking man has been Mulder's guardian angel. He has been looking out for him and has been protecting him. He's just also this kind of Luciferian figure as well, which I think is interesting. Yeah. It's a clever way of
And he said the same to Bill Mulder in, was it Anasazi, I think, about how he had protected him or something to that effect too. So yeah, you do have that history behind it. So I don't think you have this like the surprise or the revelation like you do with the little girl being the devil. But I do think that it's a well done parallel nonetheless.
Yeah, I think it's more of a peek behind the curtain. It's Mulder's fascination and desire to get the truth compared to what could have been. And I think it's really interesting. And there's a moment which we'll talk about shortly. Which is a small moment in just outside the house itself. It's when Cigarette Smoking Man says, "And why don't you take a look around, and you don't know what you know until you're leaving it." So it's like to push him into that mode of like, you need go and see what the other side is like, which is really interesting. And the fact that right at that beginning he's effectively, which I think is slightly different, is like he's been effectively, why would you want to go back to Scully? This is where you need to be now. The handcuffs will come off when you're ready to, when you don't want to leave, kind of thing. And it's interesting when they come off. And I do get to speak about Diana Fowley again, which is bizarre.
Oh, good.
It all comes full circle.
Yeah.
I mean, like,
it's not their main episode, though, so we'll skim over it. We're right.
What we should acknowledge, though, actually, and Marlene kind of made this point, but it's worth going back to and focusing on, is that like this is very much a continuation of themes from the sixth season, where in the sixth season, you have this kind of tension running through the show about like Mulder and Scully and the idea of domesticity between the two of them. So things like Arcadia, where they actually like go and live in suburbia, and you have this idea of like maybe they don't fit in, maybe there's something monstrous hiding underneath there. But even in episodes like Dreamland 1 has a sequence where Mulder and Scully are in the car and they're talking
about stopping
about
the car.
Getting out. And like what I find interesting about Mor Fati is that you get that sequence with the cigarette smoking man, where the cigarette smoking man is having that conversation with Mulder, and they do stop the car and they do get out. And I think that you could argue that this is, like, as the second part of the premiere resolving the cliffhanger from the sixth season, it's a nice thematic bridge. Because, like, and again, even in the sixth season, you have episodes like, say, Terms of Endearment, which is about, like, again, monstrosity hiding in suburbia and in these beautiful houses. And the idea of, like, what a normal, in inverted commas, family looks like and what that represents for Mulder and Scully. And obviously, even Two Fathers, One Son is about a dysfunctional family unit, and The X-Files always has been. I like the idea that like Mor Fati is kind of just wrapping up that kind of thematic baggage from the previous year and saying, well, okay, the logical conclusion of that arc, like of that story that we had in the sixth season, or that kind of like recurring thematic subtext of like, what if Mulder and Scully settled down and got a life in the suburbs? What if, well, we actually just do it? What if we just show you it? What if we just show you Mulder going to the suburbs and living that normal life that he kind of, you know, again, intersected with in Dreamland 1 and Dreamland 2, but and Arcadia, and kind of like played that out as a kind of a nightmare, as an alternative to this. I think it's a very clever way of kind of closing or putting a button on that, I think.
Yeah, and also quite a nice touch is the simplicity, because they're saying about going back to a normal life, but a lot of the push on The Last Temptation of Christ was that it was this simple life. It was simplicity of working, rather than just being a suburban home, which is obviously an updated version of what we get in the X-Files. But things like the sunflower seeds being in the fridge,
right,
for example, is
the
a perfect example
of
that.
That he mentions.
So, yeah, which is really in the mundanity and the simple life.
And you hear, I think, is either, I believe it's in that scene when Deep Throat reiterates this idea, like you've done enough, like you've sacrificed enough.
Yeah, well, that was my next point, because I know we'll talk about Cigarette Smoking Man again when we get to the kind of the Armageddon aspect, which we'll talk about when we're talking about Scully. The fact that Deep Throat's here calls him son, and you have a obviously the kind of like the father kind of son relationship without having Bill Mulder there is in itself is an interesting decision to make, and it seems to work really well, and it's a bit of an outlier in the comparisons, but I really like the Deep Throat scenes.
Yeah, no, I really like it as well. I like that quote about you're dead. No, no, just really relaxed, which is a lovely line. And like, I actually like, and bringing Deep Throat back, and obviously him being a character who like died in the first season of the show kind of haunts the show. And this idea of Mulder like having all this kind of weight on him, because mm-hmm. I think, you know, he's talking about how all these people who have like died and sacrificed for his quest, his father, Dwayne Barry, you know, the thing that affects Scully. What I find really interesting, and kind of Marlene, I think, kind of again alluded to this, kind of set this up early on, in that the idea of the sixth season is largely about resolving narrative. It's about tying up story. It's about resolving plot beats in terms of the mythology. It's like two fathers, one son. You know, again, I talked about it with yourself. I talked about it with Carl. I think we had this kind of conversation about like how much does two fathers and one son really resolve, given that like most of the named characters end up escaping at the end. But the idea was that it kind of like closed the book on the conspiracy and the mythology and the alien colonization plot, at least for the time being. And like I think we talked about like the kind of the biogenesis. The kind of question of like, well, what's happening now? Like, what is going on? What next? You know, Scully has that scene with Mulder in the elevator where she's like, look, you've exposed the conspiracy. What next? What do you do next? And I like the idea that the question in Amor Fati is like, it's kind of unspoken, but it hangs in the air. Is like, but what is Mulder going back to, basically? Like, outside of like finding Samantha, who is physically here living just across the road from him, like, what is Mulder, if he walks away from this suburban life, what exactly is he choosing? Because the conspiracy is dismantled. He knows virtually everything that he needs to know, as Marlene pointed out, about everything that's going on. He's had all of his questions answered. So what exactly is he going back to? And I like the idea that it is just a philosophical principle of truth. It's this idea of awareness, because that's the thing about like The Last Temptation of Christ, is it's a fundamentally religious text in that, and you know, and The X-Files, like as we kind of alluded to, at this stage is arguably a fundamentally religious question. The truth is out there. The truth, you know, is no longer, well, there's an alien colonization happening in conjunction with various parts of the government. It's more a spiritual question of like, well, what is the meaning or the purpose of all this? And I like that idea kind of running through the show. And it runs through the seventh season as well. We have things like NME, where I think the men in the spaceship are described as angels, mm-hmm. if I remember correctly. You have like
the boy closure. Says he's healed by angels.
Yeah. Yeah. Yes. Yeah, and it turns out to be the fallen angel. It turns out to be the cigarette smoking man.
Who also, I don't want to, it's hard to interrupt you, but I was thinking about this earlier today. He also describes, cigarette smoking man describes himself to Scully as Marjorie Butters, the older woman in the story. He says that he is her guardian angel, which I thought was an interesting connection.
And obviously then you have like the conclusion of the Samantha arc in kind of Closure and Sign on Zeet, which is, I would argue, explicitly religious more mm-hmm. than like plot-based or like conspiracy driven stuff like that. So I like the idea here that it's like Mulder's choice isn't between going back and doing a thing or stopping a thing or like, you know, fighting the conspirators. It's just an existential spiritual choice between choosing to continue to search for answers, even if the questions are more abstract and more, you know, faith-based now, to be honest, mm-hmm. or just accepting the life as has been presented to him. I like that those are the stakes. I think that's really interesting about the kind of story here.
I do too. I totally agree with that. I think it's not, you know, there's not a, like a physical reality that he's choosing like this or that, that are sort of like equal in terms of their nature. But I think the what is he choosing question, or like what is he going back to, goes back to this dream that he can used to have of the boy on the beach. Somehow, like the mystery of that, I think, is part of like what's pulling him into that other life. And I think it's kind of, I still don't know exactly how to put this together, but I think it's very interesting and somehow related that Scully has this visitation from Albert Hostein twice and almost connects through her prayer with Albert Hostein to Mulder in this vision that he's having the entire time. And even the way that the filming goes together at the end, the way the scenes are put together, makes it seem that way to me. So I think that all of those choices that he's making And that kind of like sort of almost, I mean, it is sort of a spiritual dream, I think, he's having of this boy on the beach and rebuilding the sandcastle that's the UFO, that kind of ties in to what I think Kurt alluded that we're going to talk about with the battle going on outside, and that in The Last Temptation of Christ has to do with like the destruction and rebuilding of Jerusalem. I think all of that kind of goes together, but I like that it has that very childlike like expression in this dream that he's having in his mind of the little boy on the beach.
Yeah, I mean, well, while we're there now, because the boy is something I was going to bring up as well. So you do have the direct pull of when you see Jesus in the barn that he's in, and you can see the red skies of Jerusalem outside, and you know you can feel that, and you've got the map painting in the X-Files for the UFOs that are shooting down all the skyscrapers and whatever. But you don't really have this dream within a dream in Last Temptation, and it's like almost like a replacement for God, being that the spaceship has been that questioned science versus religion, and that's the kind of thing that we're looking at. But also, like you say, the Jerusalem thing. I mean, Darren, what do you think to make to the boy? Because this is something that is slightly different to the way that the Temptation of Christ is, and I think is a really effective way of actually sort of visualizing, you know, and not having that God kind of figure there. It's more of a case of asking that permanent question.
Yeah, I mean, again, like the thing with like what the child represents is something that is still debated in X-Files fandom to this day. And like to Duchovny's credit, and I think Carter himself is like who co-wrote this. And I mean, I'm gonna guess that like a lot of the detail of like what was happening behind the scenes involving Carter and Duchovny writing together was handled in the actual podcast episode. But I do think that like Carter has come out and said, you know, David Duchovny, who co-wrote the episode with me, wanted the image of the child to be open to interpretation. So he thinks that like the interpretation of the child being either Mulder himself or perhaps representing Mulder's future or potential child are both valid interpretations of that scene. And I like that it's deliberately abstract and deliberately left open to the audience to determine on their own, which is, again, is something when we talk about the X-Files is something that I really like about the show, is that it leaves these spaces open that you didn't see a lot of in 90s television, particularly not in like primetime network television. You'd have to look to a prestige show like something like The Leftovers today to get something similar. Personally, my crazy read on that has always been that, and again, this is very reductive and probably not at all fair, but I do wonder if that image of the sandcastle on the beach with the son or with the child being constantly built and washed away and built again the following whenever it happens. I can't help but imagine, like, given Duchovny's talked about how tired he was, how exhausted he was by like the demands of producing television day in and day out, it reminds me a lot of like how people talk about making something like television, where it's like you have 6 days to make this thing, to construct this thing, this monument, and then it gets washed away at the end and you have to start over and do it all again and hope that it works itself out. So I always kind of like wondered if that was maybe what informed a lot of Duchovny's kind of work here. I do also think it's worth noting that I believe Duchovny's first child was born a couple of months before this episode aired. So it would have been when he was writing this or when he was planning this. And I suspect that probably informed a lot of the kind of subtext of it, particularly in terms of this idea of, and again, reductive, have no real source for this, I'm probably reading too much into it, don't quote this as any authority, but the idea of somebody who has to choose between a home life and a work life, and a work life that, you know, where the question is, are they going to be fulfilled in doing that work life versus the pleasures of like being at home and having a family. I can't help but imagine that may have informed or shaped some of that in terms of Duchovny writing this.
So I have a very, I'm going to tie this from a different angle. It's a less real world take, because I think it's supposed to represent our relationship with God, at least in the story, because if you see at the beginning, toward the beginning, kids building, they're building the what just looks to be a sandcastle, and then it's washed away, and Mulder encourages him, like, it's okay, you can build it again, like, you can redeem this and keep going. And then later on, when the kid is destroying it, he says, like, this is your, what does he say, like, your, I don't remember if it's sandcastle, I don't think he says ship, or spaceship. Yeah, he does, like, your spaceship, and you're destroying it. And then as Mulder goes through this, whatever, you know, in his mind, these choices he's making about his life and the normal life and whatnot, that story, that vision he's having progresses. And I think it's when, is it when the cigarette smoking man says, you like, because Mulder says that he's never seen what the boy wants him to see. And I think at that point, it's when this ship is being destroyed. Could be mistaken. But then, in,
yeah, I think it is around that. Yeah.
And then in the very end, after that last conversation with Scully, which is kind of its own sense, has its own reverence, I think, the last vision he has is of them building this together. So that's kind of why I got that, I guess, like more, you know, spiritual interpretation of it based on the story, that they're sort of rebuilding. Again, that's why I like the childlikeness of it. It's not Jerusalem and it's not, you know, this grand battle, but it's just a sandcastle spaceship. But I like the representation of that. And it, I also think, too, that that ties in, although I'm not exactly sure how, to that the voiceover when Mulder is first in the car, and it's almost like he comes to, and the little boy has walked up to him and like in the dream vision and says, what is it? The child is father to the man.
Yeah, Wordsworth, isn't it? Yeah.
I don't remember, to be honest. I think, is it, did Nietzsche not talk about that as well? Because he ties into the whole, like, the Amor Fati theme. Both in this episode, and then actually, I think that Nikos Kazantzakis was a big follower of Nietzsche for a while, too. So that's kind of how I put that together. But yeah, I think that's unique. I'm glad that they, I don't want to say diverted from the movie in doing that, but they included that, you know, and it doesn't, to my memory, have a corollary in the movie, The Last Temptation of Christ.
I'll just skip over the next scene just very quickly, because I just wanted to talk about the fact that you've got to become a father, that Diana says to Mulder, and we'll come back to Fowley in her first scene.
You've been a child with only the responsibility of a child to your own dreams and fantasies, but you won't know the true joy of responsibility until you plant your feet in the world and become a father.
And she comes, that sort of thing, is it? And she, even when they first show her, she has that kind of ominous red light behind her in the bedroom scene, too. Yeah. I fast-forwarded that the last time I watched it. Sorry, Kurt.
And Ender's got, again, kind of Jezebel-y as well. Like, it's very ominous.
Oh, yes.
It is
the music. And
it lays it on pretty heavy.
And the, some of the sibilance is actually making that snaky sound as well. I'm sure that episode, David Duchovny wrote that just for me so I could troll the entire Twitterverse with Diana Fowley images. So I'm quite happy. But I'd say, in a more serious note, with what Darren rephrased there about the fact that the father and the man, and this is the first kind of real time that we get. We've had Scully talk about stuff in Home, but this is the first time we're getting Mulder being viewed as a father, I think. I don't think there's anything before this that I can think of.
Well, there are the comical allusions, like Darren was talking about in season six, you know, like going back to the normal life, and he's the the father, the Morris Fletcher.
The Dreamland, too. Yeah.
But in terms of, like, him as himself as a father, it might be.
You talk about the ominousness of Diana Fowley. Let's talk about the handcuffs. Will only come off when Diana Fowley's in the bedroom with him. That's fine by me. I'm quite happy with that. But, I mean, the main crux of The Last Temptation of Christ and this with Diana Fowley is obviously the Magdalene stuff. And this is kind of the first part of, you know, the marriage in the film. And then when she does get pregnant and then God takes Magdalene, there's quite a lot of reference within the scenes that we see with Fowley, the children, the marriage, the death. So this is the kind of a big subject point, to be fair.
I think it's also not just, it's a big subject point, but it's also some of the filming is similar to the way that it's filmed in the movie, and just the way that time progresses. It's very surreal, you know, and then sometimes I don't know the technical term for it, but the way that they would cut a scene or not cut it. Like, there's a point when Mulder, you know, it goes from, what is it, like, they're marrying and then they have, and she's pregnant and then they have children, and then he, I think within that same frame, turns and sees himself in the mirror with gray hair and then turns around and she's dead, you know. So all of that, the way that's done, I think pulls from the way the movie is filmed to make it even more obvious. And then there's that kind of like low tone heartbeat sound, I think, underneath it in the musical score. I think it's an interesting parallel of her as Mary Magdalene too, because these are both in both of those stories, these are women that have sort of a ambiguous past connection with the main character, with Jesus or with Mulder. Like, you know that there's some relationship that they've had in the past, but it's not quite sure what it was. So I think that that's that part of it just like blends well as well.
It is the most recognizable for me. It's the most recognizable part that they've, apart from the very end with Scully and Judas.
I think too.
And these two are the main parts, I think, that kind of have that homage.
I think too that there's this, I've heard different interpretations, but there's this sense, I guess, in, you know, some threads of Christianity as Mary Magdalene as kind of like the redeemed sinner, that Jesus saw something in her, you know, like obviously, you know, in the Bible, that relationship later on, like we see in the Last Temptation of Christ, did not occur. But there is the idea that, you know, like with the scene early on when he stops the men from stoning her and has like the "he who is without sin among you cast the first stone," that whole part, you know, he's obviously seen something redeemable in her. And I think that the parallel there is Mulder still, like, in his, like, real, even in his real life, like we saw in Two Fathers and One Son and so forth, whether valid or not, you know. And it kind of comes to this at the end of Amor Fati too, when Scully says, like, "I know she was your friend," you know, that there's something in Diana Fowley that Mulder sees as being redeemable and ended up, you know, being that way, really. I mean, I think that that's another interesting part of this episode, is that, like Scully says, that it was like her key that led her, Scully, to Mulder, and that she thinks that Diana Fowley gave her this book at the end that had the, you know, the little hieroglyphs or whatever in it, the clues. And it's sort of maybe predicated by the conversation that Scully had with Diana Fowley, but there was something to her that was redeemable. And I've heard other, you know, interpretations of Mary Magdalene, that she wasn't necessarily a prostitute, but that some, you know, theology since biblical times has kind of put her in that position, but she had a different role among the disciples and so forth. So I don't think that that's really clear, but I think that the way that the story is traditionally told is that she is kind of regarded as the redeemed sinner in the same or similar sense, you know, to how Diana Fowley is in The X-Files.
Do you want anything, add anything to that, Darren?
No, I pretty much everything Marlene said there. I mean, I do think there is a lot of, like, again, Magdalene is a hugely controversial, divisive figure in terms of how she's presented in Christianity.
Mm-hmm.
Again, the idea, I think there's some debate over whether or not she's been conflated with other characters,
right,
from the Gospels in order to create this narrative of a fallen woman or a woman of ill repute who becomes Jesus's follower. And I think there was some debate about whether or not that was a political concern back when they were like writing the Gospels and trying to construct Christianity as a religion, as an organized religion. But again, that's probably something that is well outside the remit of this podcast.
Right. It's interesting, but probably outside.
But it's fascinating to delve into. And I do, like, again, this is the thing where we get back to the Diana Fowley stuff. And, like, I know that you love her as a character, Kurt. I find her a mess of uncomfortable cliches,
yeah,
and stereotypes and archetypes. And I don't necessarily, like, I wish that she was, like Barbara Hershey's Mary Magdalene from The Last Temptation of Christ. I wish she was that figure who was kind of complicated and who was... And I mean, you know, I don't think Mary Magdalene from The Last Temptation of Christ is one of Scorsese's most complicated female characters, but I do think she's interesting and has an inner life that I don't necessarily believe that Fowley has here.
Mm-hmm.
I think that Fowley is only seen through the eyes of other characters, and she doesn't necessarily,
yeah,
have a lot of agency in the narrative. Sorry, this is me being mean about Fowley. I apologize for that.
No,
it's a bit of foul play here.
She's not a character that has an inner life, though. You're right. And I think
in the
Last Temptation of Christ, some of it, I mean, this is outside of scope, too, and probably heretical, but I think that some of the characters in the last, some of the female characters, particularly in The Last Temptation of Christ, have an inner life and a sense of mentation that you don't see in them, or I don't see in them in the Bible, and perhaps I'm not reading it deeply enough, but I think that that is kind of fleshed out in that story. Obviously, it's an interpretation of it, but I think that that's very interesting. And I think that, like, you take a character like Scully, or, you know, somebody like in The X-Files that does have that, in contrast to Fowley, who, of course, is an occasional character, so you can't necessarily expect the same of her, but there is a kind of a cardboardness, or, like, it's sort of reflecting onto her what the other characters see.
Yeah, I mean, I think... I always will say that I think Fowley was a missed opportunity. That's the way that I've always seen Fowley, is that, you know, she's written badly, didn't really work, but, you know, should have worked better than it was. And I didn't like the reactions in some ways. One of my most visceral reactions is the way Scully reacts to Fowley in the end. And it's not anything to do with Fowley.
Okay.
So it's more like it's, but I, as Fowley as a concept has always been something that I've thought should have been handled better and was worth doing. It's just that they did it really badly. But saying that, you know, we're talking about the red light behind the, you know, in the bedroom, and then the following day you've got the bright light, the white lights in the you know, in the garden, and then you get the marriage and stuff like that. So there is this kind of moving story of going from the red to the white. You know, so you've, and you know, in the Last Temptation, you've got when she's taken because she's happy as well. You've got there is comparisons to be made there as well, which I find really interesting that they would do that. Scully is the complication because, you know, Jesus didn't really have that complication. Well, in mind ish. Darren's looking at me.
Well, I would say, like, again, I think one of the things that, and Marlene kind of mentioned it like back at the start and kind of laid the groundwork for this. So again, I'm just building on what Marlene said, but one of the things that I absolutely, and again, this is one of the things where I'm talking about my own understanding of my own religious beliefs, of my own experience with Catholicism. I am not an expert in Catholicism. Please consult your local priest. But what I've always found interesting about Catholicism, my relationship with Catholicism, has been the idea of doubt as being fundamental and important to it. That, like, faith isn't faith if you don't have doubt. If you don't wrestle with doubt, if you don't understand doubt, if you don't grapple with doubt, then your faith is not necessarily as strong as you think it is, because you haven't challenged it, you haven't interrogated it, you haven't studied it. And I think what I really respond to The Last Temptation of Christ is the way in which it repositions Judas. And again, like, mm-hmm. there have been various interpretations of Judas over the course of, you know, the history of the Bible and of Christianity. But, like, it positions, as Marlene pointed out, Judas is the most essential disciple. He's the most developed member of the cast. He's the one who is most important in terms of plot. He's the one who gets the most time with Jesus. He's the one who makes decisions that, like, drive the plot. And at the end, when Jesus is having this vision, when he's been tempted down off the cross, when he's having the last temptation, it is Judas who shows up and calls him traitor, because Judas has been fighting to the very last. And central to that is the idea of doubt and skepticism as a fundamental part of belief. Mm. The idea that your belief does not necessarily mean as much as you think it does unless it's put through the crucible, unless it's shaped and informed by doubt. And I think that's a very nice thematic way of tying it back to the X-Files, where the idea that, like, you know, it isn't just, like, again, this is one of the things with Scully as a character, and, we've talked about it on this podcast countless times, like, one of the great ironies of the show is that Carter originally wanted it to be a case where the skeptic would be right 50% of the time, but found that that just didn't work dramatically. So you end up with a show that it's very easy to dismiss as the show where Mulder is right 99% of the time and Scully is generally wrong, which isn't necessarily fair. I think it's reductive. But I do think, like, an interesting aspect of the X-Files is the idea that Scully's skepticism makes Mulder better.
Oh, I agree.
That Scully's questioning of Mulder makes him better. That Scully's interrogation of these things that Mulder would not question, would not doubt, would not challenge himself about, enriches both of them as characters. And I think that's a nice thematic parallel when you're doing The Last Temptation of Christ. I think swapping in Scully for Judas is pretty much perfect.
It is. I think Scully is not necessarily there. I mean, I know that Carter said at the beginning that it was going to, and you know, it sounds ideal to have it be like 50% believer, 50% skeptic, and so forth. And I mean, really, like, my favorite cases or discussions or whatever are sort of like the both of those viewpoints coming together between them. But I don't think Scully is really there to be right. I think she's there to be an advocate for a viewpoint. And I think, like, and she ties in perfectly to what you're saying with the Judas as construed in The Last Temptation of Christ, to that role, because Judas is the one, you know, that was, again, like, sent, you know, in this story, he was sent to kill Jesus for collaborating with the Romans, but ended up believing that he, you know, like, suspecting that he was the Messiah and following him. They kind of kept him on the path, which is really what Scully has done in the X-Files, and then explicitly, you know, like we're talking about in this episode of the X-Files. And I think that the aspect of Judas that is more biblically based that brings kind of Scully into that is in Gethsemane, when it looks like she really is Judas in the teaser, and in, what is it, like, later on when it kind of comes back around to that same scene when she's sort of supposedly falsifying Mulder's work. That's very much, you know, a Judas betraying Jesus kind of, you know, before the Garden of Gethsemane little plot point, you know. I'm trying to pun. It's not working out. But anyway. yeah, so I think that even those years before really makes it more resonant that Scully is like so perfectly the Judas character in this episode.
Yeah, wholeheartedly agree with that. I think it's just... It fit, everything fits into place. You know, if you're comparing the two, that it just makes so much more sense that, you know, and I think we alluded to it. I think Darren alluded to it earlier before where, you know, it's almost verbatim. I mean, at least two or three of the words mm-hmm. are exactly what is said yeah. in the film. You know, it's like traitor, you know, and I don't think dessert is in the film. Is it dessert
in the
film?
Dessert is in the book, though. It's like traitor, Oh, gosh.
I think whichever way around it is, I was expected to hear it in both. Mm-hmm. Thing. I was like, oh, it's not in there.
And then
it might well be in the book, but I'm not sure it's in the film. Yeah.
Sadly, Scully doesn't arrive with blood on her knuckles, kind of stumbling down because she's been fighting her way through the apocalypse outside. but like Judas does. I think, like, isn't that the thing in the vision? It's like he's been fighting the Romans. Like, he's been out there actually doing the work.
That's another interesting parallel, too. Like, as I think of, like, the actually doing the work, sometimes it is Scully that is... actually yeah. doing the work, you know, and Mulder yeah. is like, well, I'm gonna go and I'm gonna find out about this and that and explore and whatnot, you know. And then again, like, Scully kind of represents the side of the physical evidence, physical world, whereas Mulder is more like the intuition and sort of the matters of, not necessarily the matters of the spirit, but I think that's part of that parallel too.
As I say, the fact that we get to visualize Armageddon, which is the only time that we actually see it in the X-Files world. You know, apart from potentially My Struggle 2, which in itself is interesting, but we're not going to talk about My Struggle 2. But yeah, but that in itself is a dream, isn't it? So there's connotations in that. What do you make? I mean, this is kind of like outside the scope a little bit, but what did he make to that, actually physically seeing the fact that he's not looking out that window, that he's been completely switched off to the world, and, you know, like Jesus has gone, he's kind of lived his life, he's happy where he is, and, you know, he's not concerned about those outside world and those outside things happening.
I quite like it. Again, this is probably something where I have no real foot to stand on in terms of my knowledge of kind of like Christian theology. But I do remember, I think it's the preterist interpretation of the Book of Revelation, which is the end of the Bible, the last book in the Bible, argues that it is not prophecy, but instead a metaphorical accounting of history. And that the Armageddon, as portrayed in the last book of the Bible, is actually the destruction of Jerusalem in 70 AD or 70 CE, depending on your preference, which is what that is at the climax of the last temptation of Christ, in that it's the destruction of Jerusalem by the Roman armies. And I like the idea, and again, this is something that, again, this is a bigger thing that we don't necessarily have time to get in on. Like, the X-Files is constantly preoccupied with this idea of the threat of Armageddon, you know, the threat of colonization. Talitha Kumi mm-hmm. kind of is the first episode that really sets it. You have in, like, The Red and the Black, you have the idea that it's going to take place in 15 years from now, and then obviously in The Truth you have the actual physical date appearing on screen, and then you have a large portion of the Revival 2 miniseries spent going, I don't know, don't worry about that. Different kind of apocalypse, different apocalypse, don't worry about it. But I like the idea of, again, the apocalypse just being something that isn't necessarily the world falling apart in a very literal sense, but it just being something that's happening continuously. It just being like the red skies, it being something outside the window. And this idea of how you stop the apocalypse, like Mulder, as we mentioned, Mulder doesn't have a quest here. Like, Mulder doesn't have, he's not racing against colonization anymore, really, because, like, the colonists burnt all the conspirators to the ground. It's just you fight Armageddon by going out into the world, by being of the world, and by continuing to search for truth. Not knowing what truth is, not knowing what truth means, not knowing what the truth pertains to. You're just looking, in an abstract sense, for some sort of spiritual way of making sense of the chaotic world outside yourself. But that's enough to fight off Armageddon. And I like that idea here. And I kind of love that, like, for all that, like, the show has made a big deal about the end of the world and the idea that mankind will be destroyed and the date is set and all that sort of stuff, I kind of love that the only real visualizations of that that we have seen on the show are, by nature of it being a continuing, arguably serialized narrative on television, are like what ifs and dreams and nightmares. You know, My Struggle 2, we're not going to get into here, but that is an extended dream sequence about the end of the world. And here you have Mulder looking out the window in one of his dreams, imagining the end of the world. I like that it's not a literal or actual thing that happens. And I guess, you know, again, not to make another Time Is Now reference, but you could probably argue that Chris Carter maybe learned something from the second season of Millennium when it comes to dealing with the end of the world, which is don't break anything you can't put back in the box at the end of the day.
I think I disagree with that, because I, in both Amor Fati and The Last Temptation of Christ, I think that it's, the idea is like, this is history, and Mulder and Christ are turning their backs on it, but history is going on without them. Mulder's not looking out the window, but you kind of, like when Cigarette Smoking Man peels the window back, or the curtain back, you can see that is what's going on, and Mulder's ignoring it. Now, Scully, as she enters his world, knows that that's going on. And in The Last Temptation of Christ, the disciples know that the Jews are, you know, fighting the Romans and that Jerusalem is being destroyed and whatever. And Judas knows that as well. But then the disciples have kind of, they've gone on, they're sort of like fallen by the wayside without Jesus. But at the same time, they've kind of gone on living their lives in reality. So I think that that is an actual, I mean, who knows in the real world, but I think like in the stories, they're saying that that is an actual historical reality that they're presenting. It's not necessarily, you know, known that it's going to be going down exactly that way. But I think it's like they're avoiding whatever is coming up in history in order to, you know, have their kids and live this simpler life and so forth and not have to worry about it in their own time, you know.
I think I remember there's a couple of things just before we wrap up now that I remember. One, the fact that we look over the road and we see Samantha with three girls, which I think is interesting in itself just from a thematic point of view. That, you know, potentially clones or wherever it may well be. And I might be wrong on this, I'm just, because I might be misremembering, but we don't get anything that kind of mirrors the Paul the Apostle, Hera Dean Stanton character, do we? There's nothing really that kind of stands out for this is what's happened when you don't get involved.
Skinner, maybe a little bit. I mean, I don't know that it's a direct parallel, but do you think maybe? Because he keeps saying he doesn't want to be involved in this.
Potentially. It's during the dream sequence. I don't think there's anything that's anyone that actually kind of pushes that. This has happened because you're not here.
Yeah.
Aspect, which I think is a great scene. I love Harry Dean Stanton. That's another podcast altogether. Yeah. But other than that, has anyone got any further thoughts then before we wrap up then? Darren, do you have anything you'd like to add? Anything from your notes?
Not too much, aside from, like, again, the sense that we get, and again, this is something that will probably come up again and again over the seventh season, The X-Files, but I like that we already get this idea of, like, if the sixth season was about the idea that The X-Files might continue forever and ever and ever, because it was like, well, we reached the end of the five seasons that Carter wanted to do, the 100 episodes that Carter wanted to do, but now we've moved from Vancouver to Los Angeles and we've got our shiny new contracts and Fox got us to make a movie and we're going to continue making this thing. In the sixth season, you have this idea of, you know, The X-Files is going to continue forever and ever. In obviously, Monday is a big example of it. You could argue it's also there in Dreamland 1 and Dreamland 2. Tithonus is another one about, wouldn't it be terrible to live forever? I like that we are already getting kind of, by the seventh season, we're in like the, oh no, maybe we're not going to live forever. Maybe we're going to have to grapple with our mortality. And you get, in the previous episode, The Sixth Extinction, you get the first zombie that pops up in the seventh season, which will be a big recurring motif. Here you have like Mulder himself literally compared to a zombie in dialogue, where they ask about, is he going to spend his life as a zombie? And then obviously throughout the seventh season, you'll see a recurring motif of zombies in episodes like Hollywood AD, in which Duchovny imagines zombies shuffling around Hollywood. And obviously the Millennium episode that we
saw. Zombies in a basement.
Zombies in a basement. And I mean, even like Hungry, which is the episode directly following this, the original pitch for that had been a boy is slowly turning into a zombie. So I kind of like that you can see even here the sense of like the fear of the X-Files perhaps as a show turning into a zombie, because again, like everyone's at this stage is like seven years is a good innings. I think we're about done. I think it's time to kind of wrap up here. And there is a sense, perhaps, of that in the idea of Mulder laying down his burden, so to speak, as well, where it's like, we can imagine Mulder having an entire life from beginning to end. And kind of that setting up the idea that maybe Duchovny and maybe everybody working on the show think that, well, the X-Files is winding down. It's time to kind of close the book on it. So I find that aspect of the episode and the dream sequence kind of interesting as well. You typically get it towards the end of shows as well. Like we've been discussing this in terms of The Last Temptation of Christ. There's a long tradition of TV shows doing similar concepts towards the end of their runs. So I'm thinking of things like, is it the coma dream from The Sopranos in the sixth season, where Tony kind of is shot, I think, by Junior, and then has a coma dream about imagining his life in Los Angeles. Mm-hmm. In Mad Men, you have like this arc, I think, around the same time where Don Draper goes to California. And it's almost like, imagine your life if you just lay down your burdens and kind of gave up on it. And I do think, I like the idea of the X-Files being like, yeah, maybe this is the end for us, so let's kick off what might be our final season with looking at what if Mulder actually had a normal life and lived it from beginning to end. I think there's an interesting element there, perhaps.
Absolutely. Marlene, any final thoughts?
Yes, and I just thought of one because of something that Darren said, which is that I like this is the beginning to season 7, had season 7 been a final episode, and I believe I'm hosting Hollywood AD later in our season with Kathy Glinsky, which is going to be a lot of fun, but I think that there's a lot, that'll be a good time. But there's so much more, I think, that continues on through that in the character of Micah Hoffman and him, you know, fashioning himself to be Christ and then realizing that was blasphemy and that the forgeries need to be destroyed and so forth. So I think there's going to be a lot that'll tie into this discussion that I'll try not to go into right now in the interest of time. But I think that I would have liked almost to have that arc be the end of the show in a way, from Amor Fati to Hollywood AD. So another specific thing is in the book and in the movie when Jesus pulls out his heart. So a lot, I think, that's related to Milagro. Obviously, like the removal of the heart, but then saying that he believed in love and now he believes in the axe, essentially, once he's removed his heart. And then he kind of like comes around from that. But that ties into Milagro, which is also one of my favorite X-File things as well. Not just in the heart pulling out, but I think in a lot of the stories that are told in the sort of theological story that's told in the church relates to that. So I enjoyed that as well. I think that there's... It's not... I don't know. I think that it's a broader idea, but I think there's this importance of this individual choice in life, because we have the scene, you know, when we talked about earlier of Deep Throat telling Mulder that, you know, Mulder's not the hub of the universe. And Cigarette Smoking Man has said the same thing. Like, you're not, what was it? Like, you're not Jesus. You're not, I didn't say Muhammad, but like, you're not
the Prince, Hamlet. You're not even Ralph Nader.
Exactly. Like, your individual choices are not going to determine, you know, the future. So I like the play with that. And I like this idea that Mulder had to choose what life it was going to be. But then you go back to this Amor Fati theme of he has to choose this fate that he already has. I just think there's a lot that's interesting to think about with that. So it's really, you know, it's, to me, it's an episode that, you know, there's, I don't know how much of the surface content you can appreciate without going like into more of like the layers of the onion underneath it. Right? I just think there's so much more to it that's enjoyable. I think it could be like a good, enjoyable, fun X-File story, but I like that you can kind of take it at multiple levels at the same time.
And as myself being the shallow person that I am, I would just say, have you ever seen a operating table like that ever before or after?
I do appreciate that they go wholeheartedly you're not gonna miss it. Like,
no, because the crown and then the, I don't know what it's called, but the circle, that kind of
the halo, I do love the idea of like Cigarette Smoking Man sitting down. Like, that's probably, that has to be what the meeting was about we saw in Biogenesis, where they're like looking at casualty projections through the roof. It's like, yeah, but do you have that surgery table I wanted, the crucifix table? Like, yeah, do you think it's a little on the nose? It's like, oh, no. Halo, add a halo.
I mean, the only thing it could double up as like Da Vinci's man as well.
That's true.
Oh, can they rotate? I love the idea that they can rotate the arm, so it's not just a crucifix. And also, very quickly before we go, I just want to acknowledge it's nice to see Scorsese getting a shout out on the X-Files, because like one of the big things about the X-Files has been the production team drawing in all the movies that they loved as kids. And I think like Carter's talked about like Raiders of the Lost Ark being a huge influence on him. There's a lot of Spielberg in the show. There's a lot of like Lucas and Star Wars. Like, you mentioned the alien bounty hunter Like, that's basically Boba Fett. Yeah. And things like the opening shot of, like, Jose Chung's From Outer Space is the opening shot of Star Wars. I like that they eventually got around to working a way to do an actual Scorsese reference in here. And no, I'm not going to count the mob episode from later in the season.
well, thank you both for coming onto this supplemental episode. I think you're both doing some more supplementals as we go through season 7 as well as being on the main show. Marlene, you mentioned Hollywood AD. Darren, behind the scenes, we've already recorded the Millennium episode and we're due to be on Orison as well. Mm. So that'll be great to do that. But yeah, and obviously I'll be in scattered through the through season 7. So yeah, it's going to be a really interesting season. I'm really looking forward to seeing how it goes. I've said in the primer for this season that it's not a season that I visit very often. So it's going to be interesting for me from a reappraisal point of view. If people wanted to see or hear more from where you are, Darren, I mentioned about the Scorsese summer thing. So if everyone does want to go back and listen to your Scorsese stuff, where can people find that? And also, what else are you up to?
So I co-host a podcast with my good friend Andrew Quinn. We've been doing it for apparently 5 years now, which is absolutely insane to us as much as anybody else. People seem to like it, which is good. It's called The 250. You can find it online with a quick Google. We're on Stitcher, on SoundCloud, and iTunes, on Twitter, wherever good podcasts are not sold. We've been lucky enough to have you on as a guest a couple of times. You're on about Shutter Island, which is, and again, ironic, like that Scorsese's most X-Files movies actually followed the X-Files rather than leading into it. So like Shutter Island is a very X-Filesy movie. And also I would argue is The Irish with its secret history. So we talk about both of those on the season as well. Otherwise, you can find me. I'm on The Escapist, where I publish articles twice a week, and I do videos once or twice a week reviewing new films, covering new Marvel TV shows, and also doing just video essays with the wonderful Omar Ahmed on In the Frame. If you're listening on Patreon, just this week we will have released two videos, which I'm very proud of, one of which is on Raiders of the Lost Ark, and one of which is on James Cameron's Aliens, marking anniversaries of the release of those movies. I'm really proud of how those videos turned out, in large part because Omar is just a phenomenal editor and he really carries my ass. So feel free to check those out and give him a look. Cheers. That's me. Oh, I'm also on Twitter at Darren_Mooney if you want to come yell at me on the internet about stuff.
Does that carry your metaphorical ass or your actual ass?
he's on a different continent, so it's a very difficult, okay. And I feel like I don't know.
Or your spiritual,
I don't know
ass.
How good his back is. Yeah, my spiritual ass. I'm sitting in bed and Omar is like, "You need to record another video essay, traitor." And I'm like, "Oh, but
cowards."
But it's so warm in bed. It's like you have hot takes on Indiana Jones. It's like, yes, I do.
Marlene, where can people find you?
Oh, I am on Twitter and Facebook as Marlene Stemmy, I believe, on both. And I also now have a podcast going through all of the episodes of Cheers. It's a little independent podcast with our friend Andrew Blaker, also of the X-Cast. And it's called Norm, a Cheers Podcast. And we're trying to grow our listenership, going well so far. So those are sort of my things right now.
Excellent. You can find me on Twitter at rmuldrake. That's rmuldrake. When I'm not talking about the X-Files, I'm talking about Red Dwarf. So I'm on the Shipwrecked and Comatose podcast. You can find that on Twitter at Red Dwarf Pod. Star Trek Picard is starting to ramp up again as well. So we have Darren's been on Star Trek Make It So, our Star Trek Picard podcast.
Say the Twitter handle.
The Twitter handle is at Jean-Luc Podard.
Oh, which that's is, nice.
Yeah. That's I can't take ownership of that. Tony came up with that idea. So that's it. So those are the two best podcasts you can find me on right now. And as I say, see us through season 7 as well of the X-Cast. So until next time, thank you everyone for listening in. We will, of course, do some, we have other things happening on the network. So feel free to listen to some of the stuff that we're currently doing. That'll be straight after this. But until next time, trust no one.
Elsewhere on We Made This.
Shipwrecked and Comatose, a Red Dwarf podcast.
We are doing something even crazier than usual. We are doing 7 episodes in 7 days. Which lunatics are joining me in this journey? First up, hello Carl.
Hello, how are you doing there everyone?
And also, hello Colin.
All right.
So what we've decided we're going to do is rather than do one episode covering this magazines. We're going to do the first 7 issues, one by one, episode by episode, day by day, for an entire f***ing week. It will either be brilliant or s***.
I like how we're phrasing it as, we've gone crazy. Do you know what we're going to do? We're going to do some reading.
The Movie Palace.
Okay, let's dive in then. Let's talk Now Voyager. There's quite a lot to talk about with this film, actually. I just wanted to ask you both, first of all, sort of any interesting personal history with the film? Like, Clara, I know a lot of these films we've talked about in the past, the films that you've seen as a child and, you know, as a younger person. Is it the case with this one too?
Yes, definitely. I saw this as a kid. I don't think I quite understood it when I first saw it. I think I thought it was a romantic film. I don't think I really picked up on the mental illness and the sort of abuse.
We buy records.
Tim, it was record store day.
I was going to say, there's an elephant in the room. I don't think we have mentioned it yet in this episode, have we? I wonder if some people thought that we were going to be ice cool and not even mention record store day. Well, we are. We're doing it now.
Yeah.
Check out all of these shows and more on the We Made This podcast network. The X-Cast and X-Files podcast was created by Tony Black and is produced and hosted by Carl Sweeney, Sarah Blair and Kurt North.
You can find the podcast on Twitter at the X_cast, on Facebook by typing in the X-Cast, and in our group, X-Files Basement, the X-Cast podcast fan group, and on Instagram at the X-Cast pod.
Don't forget, you can support the show by becoming a member on Patreon. Our patrons get early access to episodes, behind-the-scenes chats with our hosts and a thriving community of X-Files, and other premium interviews and specials. To find out more and subscribe, you can go to patreon.com/thexcast. That's patreon.com/thexcast.
We are also part of the We Made This podcast network, full of popular culture shows, including our Millennium series, The Time Is Now. You can find all of our shows at our website, wemadethispod.com, or via Twitter at wemadethispod.
Thanks for listening and keep watching the skies.